Let me tell you what I'm going to try to work out here in the next, between now and 11 o'clock, before we take our break and then have any questions. I'd like to talk to you a little bit about the genesis of NDEs and where the research has gone, and then talk about some evidential cases. I even got a little, in these lectures, I have a little bit of time where I talk about NDE humor. There are some funny NDE cases, things that people report while they say they're out of their body, and they report jokes or something that happened in the room or something happened down the hall, and it's kind of funny. But it's also verifiable, because how do you know what they said 50 yards down the hall? But lastly, I'd like to end on this idea, what happens when phenomena doesn't fit your worldview? And what should we do with those? Because those are the questions I get the most. The two kind of questions I get the most, I've been doing this, second only to the resurrection, is the amount of work that I've done on NDEs. And so I get a fair number of emails. And two questions I get have to do with evidence, because I'm not only a guy who studies NDEs, I'm also into apologetics, so the you know, common ground for apologetics and NDEs are what evidence is there for NDEs. And the second question I get the most is this odd one that I just mentioned a moment ago. What happens? I've got this neighbor, and he's an avowed atheist, and he had this heart attack, and I went to see him in the hospital, and he said he went to heaven, and he met Jesus, and Jesus was very accepting of him and said, I'll see you back here someday, but it's not your time to go right now. And this guy was really surprised, but he's an atheist. What do we say about that? Those are some of the rubs. And there are a lot of those accounts. So that's kind of a little bit of an outline here. Now, in the early 70s, the NDE story revolved around the sciences and what we can tell, and at what point does a person die, and then how can you get data after that point? Would it be an indication of life after death? That's where a lot of the interest goes. People who want to be comforted, you know, when it comes to the time of the afterlife. So in the early 70s, I used to hang around with some of the big researchers who would do this kind of stuff, maybe for Raymond Moody or Ken Ring or Michael Sabom in Atlanta. He was a cardiologist. And these guys would be, you know, I'd be with them at a meeting, and we'd be sitting around and we'd be hypothesizing what would evidence look like after this point or that point. And here's what they used to say, and I'll just contrast how things have changed. But in the early 70s, they'd say, well, the ideal case would be somebody who has no measurable heartbeat. And beyond that point, they report phenomena that can be checked out. Then the next guy says, yeah, but no heartbeat, you know, that's kind of, that's difficult. How do you know there's no heartbeat? And then secondly, things happen after no heartbeat. Things don't just, you know, people don't die like they die in the old black and white Westerns, you know? They don't die like, I hid the gold. And that's not how you die. And dying is a process. And so somebody might say, well, all right, so it looks like the heart's not beating. Looks like, that's not terribly scientific. But what if some things can happen for a few moments after a heart stops beating? Then somebody says, well, what we really need are flat brain waves. All right, well, it's not all that common to hook up EEGs with people. So you don't often have heart phenomena. And then if you do, people would say, well, see, that's upper brain activity. The EEG's upper brain activity. That doesn't mean there's no brain activity. That just means as we can test, there's no brain activity. So they're sitting around saying, okay, well, a flat heart, flat brain case would be dot, dot, dot. And then as a neurologist cautioned me one time, you can't really say flat heart, flat brain, because what you need to say is no measurable activity. Okay, great. So with all these caveats, how do you know if you have something afterwards? So that's the way they used to talk in the 70s. And death was often described as, here's some definitions for death. Near death, no viable signs of death. No apparent heartbeat, no apparent pulse, so on. Okay, apparent death. Then the next level, the next most evidential level might be heart. Flat heart or very little heartbeat. Next level, brain. Flat brain, which, like I've already said, doesn't mean what exactly we think it means. But the skeptic comes in, the philosophical skeptic comes in and says, you want a definition? I'll give you a definition of death. And this is the highest level. So I'll give you the definition of death. Biological death. What's biological death? If you come back, you weren't. If you come back from it, you weren't there. Because biological death, by definition, is you don't return. Now, of course, the philosophers among you here will say, yeah, but that's kind of a little prejudicial because that assumes something like probably some view of naturalism. And so they're assuming the view of the universe is you can't come back from this because miracles don't happen. So that's their worldview. I'll just stop here to tell you a little quick little deal. Years ago, I was lecturing in the UK, and they told me I just landed, and I was groggy from jet lag and everything. I said, oh, by the way, tomorrow morning, so we're going to go to the BBC, and you're going to be interviewed by a well-known Irish talk show host, and he's going to ask you about your argument for the resurrection. Great. I am not a morning person. What time do you have to be at the studio? 6 o'clock. And I'm supposed to think through my argument for the resurrection. Yeah. Okay, great. Thanks for telling me. So we get to the studio the next morning. I walk into the room with all the mics in front of your face. And the guy was reading my resume or something, and he said, PhD philosophy, Michigan State, huh? And I said, something like that. He said, I have a PhD in philosophy. Is he joking with me or what? The talk show host in Ireland? Yeah, I have a PhD in philosophy. Really? He said, yeah. So where'd you get it? Princeton? Great. 6 o'clock in the morning, and I have an atheist talk show host with a PhD in philosophy at Princeton. He said, yeah, I studied under Saul Kripke. So great. So here's this guy at 6 o'clock in the morning with a PhD in philosophy from Princeton, studying one of the top philosophers in the world, and he's going to argue with me about whether there's anything after death. So he said, all right, well, hey, listen, so now we're ready to go on the air in just a matter of seconds. And he asked me to do this two-minute defense of the resurrection, give my minimal facts argument in 2 minutes. And as soon as I finished, the first thing he said was, that would be a miracle. He just kind of blurted it out. How can you believe in this? It's a miracle. And so we didn't have time to discuss this on the, before we went on the air. And I said, well, would I be right that you're a naturalist? And he said, I am a naturalist. And I said something like, well, look, I just spent two, it was his talk show, right? I said, I just spent 2 minutes talking about my view about how I know the resurrection is true. If you're going to use your worldview to judge my worldview, why don't you take 2 minutes and tell us why naturalism is correct? Well, it's a famous conundrum in philosophy. You can't really prove naturalism per se. And he looked at me like a deer in the headlights look, like he hadn't been asked that question for a long time. And I said, why don't you show me, if you're going to use naturalism to trump what I'm saying, show me how naturalism is true. And he looked at me and he went, yeah, I think that's a topic for another program. Okay, now here's my point. Naturalists are going to be the guys who come in, and like he tried to trump the story of resurrection, they're going to try to trump the NDE type thing. They're going to try to say, if you come back from death, you weren't, and there's nothing after death, and so on. And so you might say, well, then I'll tell you what. What do you do with the following data? I've got some empirical evidence for you. What do you do with data? And I've been in a lot of dialogues over the years. I hate them, but I've been involved in a lot of dialogues. University, in fact, I've got one coming up in a few weeks at University of Iowa with a well-known atheist philosopher. And of all the evidences, if you give them evidences for the resurrection, they will often come up with a naturalistic theory. Well, maybe this happened. But when you slide over to near-death experiences, related topic, both topics talk about the afterlife, and you give evidence for NDEs, they very frequently have nowhere to go. And there's a reason for that, as we'll get there in a minute. But NDEs are demarcated. You have to give evidence, you have to give a response after the point that can explain the data. All right, more about that in a second. So these are like your definitions. Near death, heart, brain, if you came back, you weren't. Biological death, the naturalistic definition. Now, so in the 70s, we were concerned about finding data beyond a certain point. Here's the point of death. We've got some data for you. Well, what about this definition? We got this data. What about, and you can say that we've got evidence beyond these certain points. Well, then just recently, in recent years, new understandings of death have evolved, as it happens in science and with medical definitions of death. And lo and behold, cardiologists and others discovered the following. If you have a cardiac arrest, not heart arrhythmia or whatever, but if you have a cardiac arrest, your heart's not working. Arrest, right? You have a cardiac arrest. After a cardiac arrest, in 11 to 20 seconds, certainly by 30 seconds, your brain's not working measurably. We always have to add that. As far as we know. All right, so if you have no heart activity, this is a fairly evidential state because you'd say within a minute, got no measurable heart, and no measurable brain waves, what happens if somebody reports phenomena beyond that point that's measurable? Now, no measurable heart, no measurable brain. You go, let me think about this. And what kind of evidence are you going to talk about? Well, let's say this is a hospital room. Let's say it's a surgical room, and you're being operated on. And it so often happens, the person says, well, I watched what you all were doing. What do you mean? Well, you were out. In fact, we had a rough spot there. We thought we were going to lose you. You're pretty close to death. How do you know what we were doing? Well, I didn't feel that pain of being pretty close to death. I was just kind of enjoying myself. What do you mean? Well, I was like up here looking down on you guys, and I didn't even know who that was on the bed. What do you mean you didn't know who that was? Well, first of all, you were all gathered around. I couldn't see the face. And secondly, we all judge our existence from our point of consciousness. So if I'm here, and somehow my body's over there, I don't stop and think about that. I'm here. I'm here because this is the thinking me, and that's just a, well, who cares? And by this time, I'm looking around the room because I'm kind of enjoying this bodiless kind of, that's how they report anyway. What happens if, as the reports often go, what happens if I'm attracted, I, in this, whatever this body is, there's my physical body over there, I'm attracted to where my family is. So, let's say there's a waiting room 200 yards down this hall or on the floor right above me. And I just kind of drift to where my family is, and I say, I saw mom and dad. I saw my husband, my wife. And what were they doing? Well, I don't know. Old Uncle Bill was, you know, he was pacing in the room, and somebody was crying. I don't even know who the person was. Might have been for some other patient. I'm looking in. Now, I'll let the NDE humor overlap with this for a moment, but this is a real case. This woman was taken to where, she said she was taken to where her family was, and she saw her brother-in-law, and he was pacing, and here's what he said. Look at his watch. If she's going to kick the bucket, I hope she hurry up and does it. I have an appointment in 1 hour. And when she came to, she said, did you say this? And she caught him red-handed. The family heard it. But how does she know that? Nobody came into the recovery room and said, do you know that Bob said he hoped you died if you're going to kick the bucket because he's got an appointment? I mean, that's not what you say to a person who's coming out of anesthesia, you know, in the... So how would she know that? Well, she said she watched him say it. But she was, you know, on the cart in our bed, and they're operating, and she says she's up there. Here's another one, true story. This lady died, pronounced dead. They pull the sheet over her head. Scrub nurse comes in, and she's just cleaning the room down. And pretty soon, Holly, a medical doctor walks in the room, closes the door, and starts doing things with the nurse that medical doctors shouldn't be doing with nurses. The person said I was up on my body, watched the whole thing, turned the medical doctor in. True case. I mean, I can go on like this all day long. I have another case where a surgeon, a female surgeon, at University of Texas Hospital, she worked the emergency room. Well, she was often in the emergency room. And one time at Christmas time, her shift was done, and she went and changed, and she put this dress on, and she was going to a Christmas party. And because a friend of hers had a pin-on deal, I don't know, brooch or something, that she really liked, she borrowed it from her friend, and she put it on her dress, and she's getting ready to walk out the door, and she hears this code deal going on in the emergency room. So she rushes down to the emergency room. She's in her Christmas dress with the brooch, and they work on this patient, and they get the patient stabilized, and she leaves and goes to her party. Well, it's a few days later. She'd already given the brooch back to a friend, and she's walking down the hall of the hospital after doing some rounds, and this patient's standing up in the doorway, this guy, and he's in the doorway. He goes, hi, doc. He says, you don't know me, do you? Nah, I got to say I don't. I'm the guy you resuscitated the other night. Yeah, you were the one with the dress on, right? Everybody else had the whatevers. Yeah, I had the dress on. Hey, what was that thing on your dress? Tell me about it. And the patient described it. Very accurate. She never owned it before. She never had it after. It was just for that moment. And he described it because he was watching it. His eyes were kind of glued to this thing. Now, one more. This is a very close friend of our family's. She is an emergency room. She has an emergency room specialization. She's worked in emergency rooms for 25 years. And this very elderly lady came in and just had a cardiac arrest. And they're working on her frantically, and the lady recovered. And one day she was, went to see her to see how she was doing. And the lady said, can I ask you a couple questions? And our medical doctor friend said, sure. And she said, while you were working on me, why were you doing this the whole time? And working and working and working. And she said, you saw that? And the lady said, yeah, she, but there's nothing up there. What were you doing? She said, She said, I've got this watch on my arm, and when I put my hand down, it always slides down. And so I'm shaking it back up my arm. And this patient watched her shaking her watch down and going back to work. And then the older lady, who's in her 80s, she said to our friend, by the way, she said, I heard you say a sentence that wasn't very ladylike. My mother, she's kind of playing around at this point, but she said, my mother told us we don't talk like this. And my friend got real interested and said, what did I say? And she said, well, I'm telling you, Mom never let us use this language. No, I can handle it. What did I say? She said, you said blankety blank 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 blank. And our friend was like, yeah, I said that. You heard that? Well, yeah. Well, how did you know this? And I was up above you. I was watching the whole thing. I was at peace. You were pretty frantic, but I was at peace. And she tells that story. Now, some of these accounts happen in the emergency room, like the couple I've told you. Some of them happen down the hall or the next floor. Some of them, it often seems that the longer the experience goes, the deeper the experience gets. And so, I mean, that's not a hard and fast rule, but if I were out for a few more minutes, maybe I've kind of report drifting up through three floors of the hospital. In some cases, I'm up above the hospital. I'm looking down on the hospital. That's where there's several famous tennis shoe cases where people talk about tennis shoes being on the roof of the hospital. And they describe these tennis shoes. There's one of these cases in Hartford, Connecticut. There's one of these cases in Seattle. And they send somebody out there, and there's a tennis shoe, same color, you know, right where the person says it was, but they were virtually dead, you know, cardiac arrest in the operating room. And some of them are even wilder because they concern data from miles away. Now, in one well-known case, now I check a lot of these out. I've called the people who've been involved. I talked to the lady who found the tennis shoe case in Seattle. She was a social worker who worked in the hospital and heard the woman describe it. And because the woman who had the cardiac arrest was Hispanic and had just gotten to Seattle that day, had never been in Seattle, but the woman spoke only Spanish and the social worker could speak Spanish, so they called her in to translate for the patient. And so she was in on the bottom floor of this tennis shoe and everything, and the woman said, oh yeah, there's a tennis shoe over here. And she went up there and looked and looked and looked and looked and found a tennis shoe and brought it in. And I got to know her after a few hours of interviews. And I said, so where's this tennis shoe now? She said, it was in my garage somewhere. And I said, yeah, that's a pretty valuable thing, you know, to have an Exhibit A like that around. It's a very famous story. And I said, well, what'd you do with it? She said, I don't know. My husband was cleaning the garage a few days ago. I wouldn't be surprised if he threw it away. I said, you'd throw it away like an exhibit? So, I mean, there's a number of these with some, you know, data hanging around. But in one well-known case, also in Washington, a little girl, 7-year-old girl, had drowned, quote-unquote. It's, again, you got definitions of death. She had drowned. They brought her in. She was known not to have heartbeat for 19 minutes. They brought her in. They began resuscitating her in the emergency room. And the guy who was on duty, there were two medical doctors in the emergency room, and one of them, as so often the case today, had a double specialization. He was a pediatric brain specialist. So he was a pediatric neurologist. And he's working on this gal, and she never comes to, this little 7-year-old girl. So they hook her up to machines, put her in ICU, and, you know, he goes home for the evening. Now, she resuscitated without any more medical, spontaneously. They didn't do anything else medically to her. She was hooked up to these machines, and 3 days later, she just woke up, and everything seemed to be good to go. Now, she had no brain activity, measurable brain activity, when they brought her in. And yet the first thing she says is she looks up and my friend, this medical doctor, the pediatric neurologist, she said, "You're the guy who saved me. Thank you." And he's an agnostic. And he goes, "All right, well, you're welcome." And he's trying to process this. And she said, "Where's the tall doctor without the beard?" All right, doesn't get any more interested. "I'll go get him for you." Goes down the hall, gets the guy, brings him back. And they sat there and talked to her and took notes for 1 hour. And she said, "Well, I'm in the hospital." First of all, she described everything that happened in the emergency room. "Well, give me a picture." And they gave her, 7 years old. They gave her a piece of paper and a pen. And where are things in the emergency room? "Oh, the bed is right about here, and this is here. And there was something funny over here. It looked like a balloon or something. I don't know." She's describing these things. She's drawing these pictures. And then she described what they did to her to bring her to, and they never did. By the way, he estimated that she had a one in 100,000 chance of living. He just said this off the top of her head. And a 1 in 10,000 chance of living with brain function. Now remember, he's a neurologist. She has a very little chance of living with brain function. So she's sitting there and she's going, "Oh, why'd you say this?" And she repeated sentences in the room. Then she said, "While y'all were gone, an angel came for me. Angel's name's Elizabeth." All right? There's no scientific test for angels and Elizabeth. But you listen to the story, and she said, Elizabeth, now she's all, tied down to machines. And she said, "The angel took me and let me look in to my house, and I could see what everybody was doing. My family got back from the hospital, and she talked about what her little sister was doing, what her little brother was doing. Her dad sat in his chair, started reading a newspaper. Didn't last very long. He couldn't concentrate. He got up, walked around, and mom's in the kitchen making dinner." Ah, so the two physicians go, it's a point of contact with the real world. They ask her questions like, "What was your sister playing with? What was your brother playing with? What was your dad doing? What did mom make for dinner?" And she says, "Not a big deal. I think it was some leftovers or something. It was chicken and rice." Ah, chicken and rice. So they're taking notes. They took notes for an hour. And pretty soon, here comes the family busting in the door. "How's my little girl? I can't believe this." And so the medical doctors start asking, you got to remember this night. It was just 2 nights ago, right? It's third day, 2 nights ago. What did you do when you went home to the little girl? What did you do when you went home to the little boy? And to the lady, "Do you remember what you did for dinner?" "Yeah, I just was just warming up some chicken and rice dish." All right, interesting. And all of her data checked out. But how does she know what they're doing in a home when Elizabeth allowed her to look in on them? Now, a little while ago, I said we've got these cases lately where you have no measurable heart, and they know that a half a minute later you have no measurable brain. And so it's beyond that point. So it doesn't look like involvement from the central nervous system is explaining these NDEs away very well. So these are increasing evidential states. Now, I've been a reviewer for, I don't know how long it's been, 5 years, for a Journal of Near-Death Studies. It comes out of the University of Virginia. And it's the only peer-reviewed near-death journal in the world, scientific-type data. But this is strange. There's a list of reviewers at the beginning. Many of them are either MDs or psychologists, clinical psychologists, PhDs, relevant fields, psychology, medicine. What's going on with these people? But here's Habermas in philosophy. What's he doing there? They teasingly call me the Christian reviewer. Now, that doesn't mean anybody else, that doesn't mean no one in that list is a Christian. But it means that the Christians in the list have other specializations. And I get the articles to review that have to do with religious stories, Christian accounts, and whether I think this passes muster to get into the journals. I'm one of a couple people that, you know, judge articles for that. Now, some of the articles I get, back to this last topic, are really kind of strange. And some people report things that don't always follow the Christian worldview. You know, you have atheists who say they've had a really good time. A famous atheist, have you ever heard of A.J. Ayer's near-death experiences before he died? You have? A.J. Ayer, a very famous British atheist, had a couple near-death experiences before he died and wrote an article. The title is very odd for a naturalist. What I Saw When I Was Dead. Okay, well, you're a naturalist. You shouldn't have seen anything when you were dead. So he tells this account, and he was in the hospital, and he was pretty elderly, and everybody else sees a yellow light, gets taken in by this incredible feeling of love and everything else. I mean, philosophers are different though, right? A.J. Ayer says, I was standing before a red light, and he wouldn't call him God, because he's an atheist. He said, I was given to believe this was the superintendent of the universe. Well, that's what I always thought. I always wanted to meet the superintendent of the universe. We won't call him God, though. And there's these two creatures, and they were arguing. You know what Ayer said he thought they were? He dubbed one of them, he said, was space, and the other one was time. Yeah, okay, right. So, he's in the presence of the superintendent of the universe, and he said, I was profoundly uncomfortable the whole time I stood there in front of him. I mean, this wasn't fitting his worldview. And then he said, I believe it was real. I could have misremembered some things, like seeing space and time, but I think a lot of this was real, he said. And I think it's veridical. I think it's truthful. He thinks he was really there. I mean, I'm telling you, if you ever interview somebody who's had a near-death experience, they will tell you it's impressive when you talk to them, because they'll tell you it's the most real thing that ever happened to them in their life. They're utterly realistic, utterly transformed, utterly. In one survey, in a lot of surveys, the peace element is very high, the amount of, you know, like they were figuring out secrets of the universe or something. And then they realized maybe death was a lot easier than they thought. And there's an afterlife. So these things all kind of made them relax a little bit. In one survey, 100% of the near-death experiencers felt peaceful and joy during their experience. But what if you're an atheist? Now, A.J. Ayer did not feel that. He was profoundly uncomfortable the whole time in front of this red light. But he comes back, and here's the importance of our worldviews. Here's the importance of how our worldviews color what we believe. He ends the article, What I Saw When I Was Dead, and he ends the article, and here's what he says. For all my atheist friends in the U.S., North America, he says, don't worry. I'm still an atheist. That's how he ends the article. Don't worry, I'm still an atheist. But he really thinks he had this near-death experience. He thinks it was real. And I know a guy who knows him pretty well, and he said before his death, a couple things happened to A.J. Ayer. Before his death, my friend tells me he became a dualist. Now, that's pretty interesting, because there's not a lot of atheist dualists in the metaphysical sense that I'm using it. He was open to changing a bit of his view of reality from this thing. Secondly, a report came out in a Canadian newspaper that before he died, he had become profoundly religious. And he used to meet with F.C. Copleston, the well-known Jesuit philosopher of history, historian of philosophy. Those are two different fields. Famous, the guy who wrote a series of books on history of philosophy. And he used to meet with Father Copleston, as they called him, who was a prominent philosopher. He's had a famous debate with the atheist Russell before a few years before that. But he used to meet with Ayer. And there's some extenuating circumstances that before his death, something spiritually may have happened to him. There's even some speculation that he may become a Christian. Now, you got to know this guy because he's one of the most famous guys in the 19th century, and Christian and Ayer don't really go together. Okay, but what about this other? Okay, so that's one where something happens that fits the Christian worldview. Oh, well, that's cool. He stood before this red light. He was profoundly uncomfortable. That sounds a little bit like a life review. It sounds a little bit like judgment. Yeah, that's keeping with the Christian worldview. I've got an article called, here's the name of the article, "I Was an Atheist Until I Died." That's another one. All right, those kind of fit our worldview. But what happens when you have experiences that don't, when you have appearances that don't? I mean, cases like this. Someone says, well, I'm Hindu, and I was before one of the Hindu deities. You go, okay. And I was welcomed into the afterlife, but I wasn't really ready to go, and so I came back. All right, that's a little rough on my worldview. Or what if someone says, I was told, I'm not religious, but I was told that all religions are ways to God. I thought it was pretty cool, and here I am. Now, what do we do with data from near-death experiences that seem to go against our worldview? And there's a lot of it. There's a lot of things that support our worldview. For example, almost 20% of NDEs are hellish in nature. Well, okay, that's another one on the side of what I would expect. But there's too many on the side of, you know, there was no hell. Everybody was going to a good place. I heard the discussions, and I was profoundly affected by this light. This is probably the most common testimony here. I was profoundly affected by this light. I didn't have to say anything. The light was unconditional love, and it was incredible. It was fantastic. You're not a Christian. Oh, no, I'm not even religious. Well, you weren't supposed to see that. I did. Now you walk away thinking you should become a universalist or something, you know? We're affected like that. Okay, so I get asked a lot, what do I do with these, the ones that agree are cool, the ones that don't, what do we do with the phenomena? And to me, it's not difficult at all. And here's the way it works. There's a lot of NDE data that something objective is going on. The person can mess up a lot of things because our interpretational apparatus is not always clear, especially when you're close to death, especially in a room where everybody's going crazy trying to read this machine and get this one and get this guy quick and stat this. And it's a confusing time for everybody. So I don't expect a lot of what you report to be factual. It's almost like sorting out the truth from false in a dream, you know. But some of it makes sense. Because you can tell what your mom made for dinner two nights ago. And there's some other equally incredible accounts where they know the people had no measurable brain or heart activity and they're reporting data. But what do you do with these other ones? Okay, here's my rule. And I've done some articles on this in journals, and to me this is the most, I mean it's an easy way to figure it out. It's just applying some criteria to these tough questions. And it goes like this. When people report data for NDEs, when they report evidential data, it's this worldly data. Now think about it. If I can verify it, it's because somebody in this world was out in the parking lot or up in the family waiting room, or there was a doctor there who was going like this, or wearing a brooch before leaving for a Christmas party. Confirmable things are this worldly data. I can't confirm angel's name Elizabeth. I don't have anywhere to say, yeah, that meshes with my view of heaven when I was there. That doesn't fit. So all the evidence is this worldly. And maybe that's early in the experience, and I can expect the person to be a little more objective at that point before things get going here. But at any rate, when a person says, I was drifting away, all right, I was in heaven and I saw Jesus. I was in heaven and I saw an angel. And I was enveloped by the most incredible light and love I'd ever experienced. Okay. How do I know that's not a dream? I'm not saying it is, but how do I know it isn't? I don't have any data. I don't know. If my standard is tell me something I can check out, more interestingly, tell me something I can check out when, as far as we know, your brain and or heart are not working. Those are recognized evidential standards. And I will tell you this, NDEs have been written up in more than 20 different medical journals. How do they get there? Now, a lot of them are negative. Yeah, these are funny stories. And medical doctors talk like this regularly, by the way. Here's naturalistic theories. I told you there was a line of demarcation. I would come back to this. Medical doctors talk like this. Well, maybe it's temporal lobe seizure over the right ear. Maybe temporal lobe, you know, when we work with epileptic patients and they have to be conscious and you stimulate this and they say they see lights and tunnels. It seems like it's contrived. I mean, it seems like if you probe in certain areas, we're all human beings, and the reason the stories are all the same, similar, is that we have similar brains, and you can probe here or there. Maybe it's temporal lobe seizure. Maybe it's oxygen deprivation. And they come up with these medical explanations that are really the equivalent for NDEs that hallucination or stolen body or legend would be for resurrection. But here's the problem with NDEs. Here's why NDEs are so difficult. All the medical or other accounts of what may have been the case, they explain data in surgery or in the hospital or in the bed at home. They explain what your brain could have done. And if you're not thinking clearly, you could say, yeah, you're right, I could have imagined it. But what do you do with rice and chicken
3 miles away? What do you do with, I hope Sherry kicks the bucket because I have an appointment. What do you do with what the doctor and the nurse were doing? And of course, the further away from the room, the more evidential it is. Because you could say if death is a process, they were keep catching little snippets in the room before they finally and irreversibly died. But some of the stories are out there, like the one I told you about, the little girl. And none of the subjective medical explanations, temporal lobe seizure, oxygen deprivation, they could have been taking a drug that's hallucinogenic. None of those can explain why you saw data that were reported immediately that could be verified. So there's the line of demarcation is evidence at a distance. Now different people like different kinds of evidence, different researchers like different kinds. But the point is there's data that you shouldn't have perceived, especially not in your frame of consciousness. But when you start talking about Jesus and angels and heavenly things, sorry, I got no data. Now, you affect me, I can hear the story, and I can feel warm and fuzzy, but I don't know if you ever were there. And for that matter, some in the years go, maybe it was all a dream, I don't know, I can just tell you it was real to me. I was there. If I was anywhere in my life, I was there. It was the most real thing that ever happened to me. And they'll say things like, I am more sure that I was there with an angel than I was that I stopped in the supermarket last night and bought a loaf of bread. They'll say things like that. And they're very persuasive, but I don't have any data that they were in heaven. So, if you report something relative to rice and chicken, or what happened on another floor, are they tennis shoe up on top of the building, and they go up there and there's a tennis shoe? Why should you keep going like this in the emergency room? There are things that are measurable, but I can't measure heavenly reports. And so, my rule is, I've got to take everything heavenly with a grain of salt. And the knife cuts both ways. So, when the Hindu says I was standing in front of the Hindu deity, I say, really? And I just put it on hold, because I don't have any data. But the knife cuts both ways. I have to treat the Christian the same way who says I was standing in front of Jesus and I was enveloped with love. And now I know the answer to the question, why has God seemed silent all these years? I just know when I was standing in front of Jesus, it was like I was his whole universe. That's the way they talk. It's very impressive, but it's not evidential. Could have happened. You can't prove you were driving down the highway last night. I wasn't with you. Nobody else. You told me where you're going. Well, I won't argue with you. But I'm not going to base my worldview on it. So, you say, well, 18% of these cases are hellish cases. That might fit the Christian worldview, but I'm not going to write a book about NDEs and hell. Because I don't have any data. So, the knife cuts both ways. When it affirms Christianity, maybe so, maybe no. When it disconfirms Christianity, maybe so, maybe no. I mean, what's different from a person saying I stood in front of Shiva and a person who writes a book on Hinduism that you're reading for a world religious class here, and the person says, well, we all know Shiva exists. Oh, really? Okay, well, this is a book on Hinduism. Well, I mean, just something you take and move right on, but it's not evidence. You just hear it. And so I don't have any issues with either conflicting or confirming evidence from quote-unquote heaven, because I don't have data. But I'll tell you who the odd man out is in these experiments. Naturalists. Naturalists struggle with this, because all the religions of the world, pretty much, they're going to be on the side of the NDEers. They're going to say, see, I told you, there's an afterlife. And you guys who don't believe in it, you're wrong. We've got scientific data now. That's what they talk. And it's really hard in naturalism. I'm reading an article right now, the journal article is due Monday. And I'm talking about changing its theological reflections on how things are changing today regarding the resurrection. And I give six conditions, things that have changed, to make people more positive about resurrection. But some of those changes are due to things that happen in our society. And near-death experiences are one of them. Intelligent design type reports are another one. A return to data for the Gospels, when the Gospels haven't figured in critical reporting for a long time. They love Paul, they don't like the Gospels. And now the Gospels are coming back. And I said last night, if you're up in the timeline, that some skeptics are putting Mark back at 40 AD. Things are changing that help people look more to a supernatural type report. Double-blind prayer tests. And I do this and people say, you know that most of the double-blind prayer test ones have been run in very well-known hospitals and research places around this country, secular schools, very big-name schools, Duke, Harvard. Do you know that all those were bad? That's what they're telling me. The double-blind prayer test didn't work. They almost never work. There's a couple of really major ones that hit home runs. Do you know about those? No. They've both been written up in peer-reviewed medical journals. So people are affected when they hear things like double-blind prayer. Healings. What about Craig Keener? He was here, what was that, 2 years ago, Matt? He was here, and he's written something that's already become a classic. Two volumes, over 1,000 pages, of reported medical healings from around the world. And some of these are incredible. Some of them are evidenced. There are people present, like medical specialists. One of my favorite ones in the book is, this little child had a club foot. Now, for whatever reason, atheists often say, all right, I'll tell you the kind that would impress me. Tell me one where somebody grows back the limb they lost in the accident. That seems to always, you know, it's always like the limb is the one in the philosophical literature. All right. In this case, this little child had a club foot. In a sense, a foot that's not, you know, was amputated or something. I mean, it almost looks like that, right? And they were taking the child in for surgery. And the minister said, "Can I pray one more time?" "Yeah," the surgeon said, "yeah, you can pray." Puts his hand on the child and he prays. And the surgeon says, "I cheated. I kept my eyes open and I watched. And I saw that little child's foot open up during the prayer." Almost like the leg being replaced, right? And needless to say, we didn't do the surgery. Now, the book is, most of them are just anecdotal, thousands of cases. But what do you do with the ones like that? What do you do with the ones that are confirmed with pre and post MRIs, pre and post CAT scans, pre and post x-rays? So the better we get at measuring these things, we have healing reports, double-blind prayer, near-death phenomena, intelligent design. There are a lot of reports going on in the world today. You may like some and not like others. Put together, you put the whole group together, and it's no wonder that naturalism is losing ground today. There's a number of discussions, a number of places where naturalism is on the way out. A number of surveys where millennials are more open to supernatural. They're more religious, but they're not into organized religion, right? That's the story. But they're more religious. They believe in healings, and they believe in prayer. Got a letter, email from a guy this week who says, "I'm an ordained minister, but I fell off the truck, so to speak. I've lost my faith. I'm an atheist." And the end of the email says this: "Can we talk? And in the meantime, would you pray for me?" An atheist saying, "Please pray for me." I got an email from a guy one time saying, "I'm an agnostic, but I don't want to go to hell. Help." That's the kind of world we live in. And I'm just suggesting that NDEs are one phenomena among those that help us with this changing idea that we're moving in the direction of a supernatural, religious, openness kind of world where we've been denying it for decades because of the prominence of naturalism.
One day when heaven was filled with his praises, one day when sin was as black as could be, Jesus came forth to be born of a virgin, dwelt among men, my example is he. The word became flesh and the light shined among us, his glory revealed. Living he loved me, dying he saved me, and buried he carried my sins far away. Rising he justified freely forever. One day he's coming, oh glorious day. Far away, rising, he justified freely. dying he saved me. Buried he carried my sins far away. Rising he justified, freely forever.